Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Perhaps the most visible breast cancer meeting presentation of the last few years was Dr. Kim Blackwell's ASCO plenary talk on the AMELIA trial, comparing the antibody-drug conjugate emtansine trastuzumab, or T-DM1, to lapatinib capecitabine. I met with Dr. Blackwell to find out her take on these landmark data, and to begin, she commented on the mechanism of action of T-DM1.
In the simplest of terms, this is trastuzumab with a very stable linker and a cytotoxic known as DM1, or derivative of maytansine. The cytotoxic was carefully selected because of its need to be chemically able to be bound to trastuzumab without interfering with trastuzumab's ability to bind to the external domain of the HER2 receptor. I think biologically it's also important that people know that the antibody trastuzumab binds pretty close to the surface of the cancer cell and therefore allows for pretty quick internalization of this complex known as T-DM1. So AMELIA looked at T-DM1 and compared it to at least my old friend lapatinib and capecitabine. And I think this was a good comparator arm. Patients had to have progressed on paclitaxel or taxane. They had to have progressed on trastuzumab. And the study enrolled first, second, third metastatic HER2 overexpressing amplified patients. The accrual goal was actually 970 patients. We accrued a few more than that. And the patients either had to have received a taxane and trastuzumab and progressed on both regimens in the metastatic setting, or about 12% of the patients actually had gotten a year of trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting and then relapsed within 6 months. So no one who got, you know, a year of trastuzumab and then went on for 4 years and then relapsed were enrolled in the study. So kind of a heterogeneic population of patients. So the patients were randomized to either capecitabine, lapatinib, or this new drug, T-DM1. And the study had two co-primary endpoints. The first was progression-free survival determined by an independent review, and the second was overall survival.
I've got to say, I was surprised that you had a superiority endpoint, because I would think that if the efficacy were the same, it would be preferable because of toxicity.
I would think so too, and I actually was thinking that maybe the T-DM1 would be better in activity in terms of you could just get more of it in. This is a really easy drug to give. And so one of the things that I spent a lot of time talking about at ASCO, in fact, probably a whole 30 seconds of my 15-minute presentation, was in fact, we paid close attention to, in both arms of the study, how much drug was actually given. And this is something known as median dose intensity. And when you actually look, the dose intensity for the lapatinib arm was 94%, meaning that patients actually really did get the lapatinib in on this study. And then with T-DM1, it was 100%. So as much as we think a lot about dose adjustments with lapatinib and capecitabine, we were able to get the combination into these patients, and then we still saw a benefit to the T-DM1. So I hope that makes sense, but
no,
at the end of the day,
that's interesting.
I was thinking that maybe the reason T-DM1 would be better than capecitabine and lapatinib was just you're able to get more in, and we were able to get more into patients in both arms of the study than I had anticipated.
Yeah, that kind of thought came up when they had the neoadjuvant studies comparing trastuzumab and lapatinib, where trastuzumab looked better, and I kind of wonder whether same thing, and maybe they never really got the lapatinib.
Yeah, and you know, we're seeing that same phenomena. We saw it in ALTO, the adjuvant study, the paclitaxel lapatinib arm. That study had to be closed early due to toxicity. And then at ASCO this year, Karen Gelman presented an NCIC study of taxane lapatinib versus taxane trastuzumab first-line metastatic breast cancer. And if you look, it just doesn't appear that the paclitaxel lapatinib was very well tolerated. And obviously there was, for those people who aren't familiar with the study, there was actually a survival detriment to paclitaxel lapatinib compared to paclitaxel trastuzumab. I don't think lapatinib is a dead drug. I think it actually has a role, and maybe we can talk about some of the patients that I would use lapatinib in. But I think it's a very difficult drug to combine with chemotherapy compared to a monoclonal antibody, and that's mainly due to its HER1 or EGFR inhibition, the diarrhea in particular. So unlike many of the lapatinib studies I've been involved in, Amelia appeared with very close dose adjustments to be able to get the lapatinib into patients.
And can you talk about what was seen?
Sure. So the study met its first co-primary endpoint, which was progression-free survival. Progression-free survival was improved in absolute terms by about 3.2 months in favor of the T-DM1, and the hazard ratio is 0.65, so a 35% proportional improvement in progression-free survival, amounting to about 3.2 months. The p-value, I just can't resist saying it, is less than 0.0001, so highly statistically significant. The other co-primary endpoint was overall survival, and at the time, the progression-free survival event rate was met. That prompted a planned interim survival analysis. The median overall survival at the time of the progression-free survival analysis for CAPE and lapatinib was 23.3 months, but the median overall survival for T-DM1 had not been reached. When you look at the hazard ratio for survival, it's a 0.621. That gives you a p-value of 0.0005. It seems like that should be statistically significant, at least in my simplest of statistical reasoning. But the preset efficacy stopping boundary, because this was a planned interim analysis, had to be a p-value of 0.0003. So it didn't meet its statistical efficacy stopping boundary. The other things the study showed was that T-DM1 as a proof of concept for antibody drug conjugate was very well tolerated. And without going through all the nitty gritty details, the T-DM1 had primarily as grade 3-4 adverse events, laboratory abnormalities, elevations in AST, ALT, and then this weird phenomenon that's been described with T-DM1 over all of the phase studies that have been done, which is this phenomenon of thrombocytopenia. It's transient. It occurs somewhere between days 8 and 10 generally. So if you don't look for it in between the 21-day cycles, you might not see it. And when we looked at transfusion requirements and grade 3-4 hemorrhage between the two arms of the study, there was absolutely no difference, really indicating that it is a transient phenomena. And of course, I'm not a hematologist, but the theory is that there must be some binding affinity to the trastuzumab, the linker, and the DM1 to the platelets, although that's still under investigation because it's not exactly clear why we would see this if the chemotherapy is only being internalized and delivered to cancer cells, not bone marrow. And then we saw a lot of diarrhea and hand-foot syndrome with the control arm, which is described. It was about the same, about 1 out of 4 women experienced grade 3-4 diarrhea. And about 15% patients had grade 3-4 hand-foot syndrome. So, you know, the adverse events in the control arm were actually what we would have expected. The thing that I think is meaningful about these differences in toxicity as a practicing clinician is that the things that we saw in the study for the T-DM1 really didn't make an impact on patients' quality of life. And we actually did take great care to look at quality of life. We used a FACT-B scale that was actually one of the key secondary endpoints. And when we looked at quality of life as measured by this, there was a over 2-month improvement in time to developing new symptoms in favor of the T-DM1 or any symptoms. And that includes toxicity or impact on functional scales. So I think all around, T-DM1 not only was a very active agent, it appears better than capecitabine and lapatinib in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival, but it seems to be what we've been really searching for, which is cancer treatment without chemotherapy side effects.
Can you talk a little bit more about the thrombocytopenia and liver enzyme elevations in terms of when they're seen and what you do about it?
Yeah, sure. So there are well-described dose adjustments that were actually followed in the study for T-DM1. So the drug is dosed based on milligrams per kilogram dosing. And the first dose reduction, you go from 3.6 milligrams per kilogram to 3 milligrams per kilogram. And then the second dose adjustment is 2.4 milligrams per kilogram. And if you run into any other grade 3, 4 toxicity, of course, we don't have the label for the drug, but it would be recommended that the drug actually be stopped after you do these two dose reductions. So because of its long half-life, it's not going to be like dosing weekly chemo. So if you give every 3 week paclitaxel, you can dose adjust it and give it weekly. You can't do that with this drug, given the long half-life. So that's an important kind of clinical pearl there. And then there are these two planned dose adjustments based on grade 3-4 toxicity. The thrombocytopenia that was seen amounted to about 13.5-14% of patients experiencing grade 3-4 thrombocytopenia. So that's platelet counts less than 100,000, and that's something that certainly, at least historically, could put patients at an increased risk for bleeding. There was no grade 3-4 or hemorrhage-related deaths in the T-DM1 arm. There was no difference in the transfusion rate. There was very little differences in anemia. There was no grade 4 anemia seen in either arm of the study. And about 2.7% of patients developed grade 3 anemia with T-DM1 versus 1.6% of patients in the control CAPE lapatinib arm. So all these things really add up to the fact that we see this drop in platelets, but it doesn't really result in an increased risk for bleeding or blood transfusions. And what I've been telling people who are interested in this phenomenon is, if you're not checking every 21-day labs, you're probably not going to see it. Patients should be aware of it. They should be just like they would on normal chemotherapy. If you notice increased bleeding or you're having excessive nosebleeds, then you should probably check. But my guess is the package insert will not have frequent platelet checks because the severity of the drop in platelets really didn't amount to any clinical phenomenon. Now, the other side effect that we saw with T-DM1 is this increase in liver enzymes. And we saw increased liver enzymes in both arms of the study, but it was about 2.5 times greater in the T-DM1 arm than the capecitabine lapatinib. So as many people know, you can see elevation in the AST and ALT with capecitabine. You can see elevation in the AST and ALT with lapatinib, and it's something that needs to be monitored when patients are receiving both of those drugs. The same's going to apply to T-DM1. About 1 out of 4 patients had an increase in their AST, but when you actually look at severe increases in AST, it's about 3-4%. So again, I think it's something that you'll, if you're prescribing the drug or administering the drug, you'll need to check the liver enzymes every 3 weeks. There is dose adjustments, as we just kind of discussed. And I think that's about all that I can say. I will point out that it appears as though the AST and ALT elevations occur more frequently with repeated doses of the drug. And that's being further studied, but my own experience in administering the drug on this trial and other trials is we saw the liver enzymes. When we saw it, it appeared it was on patients that have been on the drug for a long time. So it's just something to be aware of.
So the next usual question would be, what does this mean in terms of taking care of patients and new research ideas? But I think before I asked you that, I need to ask you a little bit about pertuzumab, because that's something else that's sort of on the scene all of a sudden, just FDA approved. And I think whatever happens with T-DM1 also has to be considered in that context. And I'm just kind of curious, maybe you can just sort of review what we know about pertuzumab, the FDA indication label, and how you're approaching its use right now in your own practice.
Sure. So the pertuzumab study, or the pertuzumab approval, was based on the CLEOPATRA study, which I participated in, and many of my patients were brave enough to participate in as well. And this was a first-line metastatic trial. So just to compare and contrast for the practicing clinician, Amelia was first, second, and third line, and it required some flavor of trastuzumab refractoriness, either rapid relapse after adjuvant trastuzumab therapy or progression while receiving the metastatic setting. CLEOPATRA is a very different population of patients. None of these patients had seen trastuzumab in the metastatic setting, And so you really need to think of the two studies as applying to very different patient populations. Pertuzumab was what I like to call layered on top of the backbone of docetaxel and trastuzumab. And right after it was approved, they did an updated survival analysis because Cleopatra had remained blinded and showed that there was a survival advantage for adding the pertuzumab on top of the trastuzumab and docetaxel, as well as the already known improvement in progression-free survival of about 6 months. Cleopatra's an interesting study because it really proved to me that trastuzumab works in trastuzumab-naive, HER2-driven, centrally confirmed HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer patients. Patients did extremely well in both arms of the study. And I think with the survival advantage, the standard of care will be pertuzumab, trastuzumab, and docetaxel. I think what we're all grappling with is, are we going to be able to use the combination outside of the first line setting, outside of the actual eligibility for the Cleopatra trial, and get it covered? I don't see any reason why patients wouldn't benefit in the second, third, and fourth line, but that was not the study question in Cleopatra. And then I think the other question in my practice and in many people's mind is, docetaxel for patients facing metastatic breast cancer is a particularly difficult regimen to get patients through. I think we should just recognize that. We know that docetaxel is approved at 60, 75, and 100 milligrams every 21 days of metastatic breast cancer. And in Cleopatra, they started at 75 milligrams per meter squared, and it was a clinician's choice if they actually wanted to go up after the first cycle if the patient tolerated the docetaxel to 100 milligrams per meter squared. In my practice, I would never give 100 milligrams per meter squared to someone facing metastatic breast cancer. I just think it has too many side effects and is probably too high of dose for patients. So the second question about Cleopatra is really, how much docetaxel do you have to give? And do you keep giving it? Do you drop it out? And when I give the combination of docetaxel, pertuzumab, trastuzumab, I will almost certainly set a limit to the amount of docetaxel. I'll set an expectation with the patient that we're going to give it. If we run into toxicity, we'll dose reduce, and probably not much past the sixth cycle. And then I'll just drop it out and give the dual antibody combination and probably restage after about 9 weeks of the dual antibody just to make certain that the chemo backbone wasn't necessary.
So lots of questions out there, and we're just going to have to see what happens in terms of third-party payers, I guess. But one that I've heard is that we've kind of evolved into this model of metastatic HER2-positive disease of continuation of anti-HER therapy or continuation of trastuzumab and switching the chemo. What do you think about, again, putting aside reimbursement, that strategy in terms of pertuzumab, trastuzumab, patient develops progressive disease, would you consider keeping both going and switching the chemo?
Yeah, so I think for me, the biggest issue in continuing the pertuzumab, which we don't have, and we didn't have with trastuzumab in all fairness, is it safe to continue it and then throw some other stuff on top of it, whether it be chemotherapy, a different kind of chemotherapy, or another HER2-targeted agent, which we're all interested in doing. Marianne, which was a first-line study, is looking at taxane trastuzumab versus T-DM1 plus pertuzumab versus T-DM1 alone. So we will have some safety data about, you know, continuing pertuzumab and then throwing T-DM1 on top of it. And in the absence of that safety data, I would probably be a little reluctant, even if I could get it paid for, to just continuing both antibodies in the absence of safety data. In my practice, I'm thinking a lot about rebound, and that's something that I think we're starting to learn more about. We've seen it in the colorectal literature with bevacizumab. It appears as though continuing it, I'm not a colorectal expert, but continuing it perhaps is a wise decision based on some of the data that was updated at this year's ASCO meeting. And I will say in my own practice, I do think we see this rebound effect. I have had patients where you stop the trastuzumab to put them on lapatinib and their disease seems to accelerate. I've seen patients, I have one patient that did extremely well on a combination of fulvestrant, lapatinib, and trastuzumab for over 2.5 years with brain mets. And then her disease progressed within her liver. And we put her on Bolero 3, which is a vinorelbine trastuzumab versus vinorelbine trastuzumab mTOR inhibitor study. And her disease just blossomed. It went completely out of control. And I think it was because we stopped the lapatinib. We've been having some kind of discussions in the breast cancer world about trastuzumab and stopping it, and is there a rebound effect? But I think clinicians need to think about kind of if patients have been on a treatment for a long time, and then at the first restaging on new therapy, that disease has gone out of control, I certainly would think very hard about putting them back on whatever biologic had kept their cancer under control for a while.
A lot of people are thinking about either paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel with pertuzumab and trastuzumab. Do we have any data on that, or are we going to get any data on that?
So I don't think we're going to get any data on that because the effort now for pertuzumab is really its use in the adjuvant setting. I'm sure there will be some small, if they're not already done, some safety studies, but whether or not that will ever be included in the label for the use of pertuzumab in the metastatic setting is unlikely, at least in my mind, given the current environment and how much money and time and effort it takes to get these expanded labels. I wouldn't have any problem if I could get it covered using nab-paclitaxel or paclitaxel in place of the docetaxel. And for my practice, where about once or twice a week that when the first few drops of docetaxel are going in and the patient's having trouble breathing, and then we have to do 5 doses of steroid, I think after that first dose, we'll clearly be switching to nab-paclitaxel or paclitaxel.
How about endocrine therapy / pertuzumab / trastuzumab?
Sure. So what I want to do in practice and what actually gets covered are probably 2 different things. I am concerned that I will not get the pertuzumab covered in combination with endocrine therapy. So again, you're going to have to give some docetaxel, pertuzumab, trastuzumab for a couple cycles and then drop it out. And it's certainly in ER-positive patients, I'll add or layer back in the endocrine therapy.
You mentioned the adjuvant setting. We have the AFFINITY trial looking at pertuzumab, kind of like the CLEOPATRA, but in the adjuvant setting. What other trials are being looked at in the adjuvant setting? What about T-DM1?
So T-DM1 maintains all of the activity of trastuzumab. So the antibody is intact, and so it would make sense to move T-DM1 into the adjuvant setting. It's just about 6 months behind pertuzumab. And the real question for those of us who think a lot about these clinical trials in HER2-positive adjuvant setting is, are we brave enough to give up the chemotherapy? And T-DM1 by itself has a cytotoxic. It's just not a cytotoxic in the classic sense. It's a cytotoxic that's being delivered to the HER2 overexpressing cells. But metastatic disease and micrometastatic disease, which is what we're treating in the adjuvant setting, are probably 2 different things. And so I think there's been a bit of a reluctance amongst the breast cancer community to use T-DM1 by itself in the adjuvant setting and not layer some chemotherapy on top of it. So my hope would be that very shortly we will have an adjuvant study that would allow for T-DM1 as a single arm, because women don't lose their hair. And it doesn't have the classic toxicity of chemotherapy, but it's just a matter of how brave are we to do it as a single agent as opposed to T-DM1 plus, let's say, a taxane, where we're not really, making a step forward in getting away from the chemo. We're just adding on top of the chemotherapy we already have. And so there is a lot of discussion about how to move T-DM1 into the adjuvant setting. Should we do it like a post-neoadjuvant, this idea of like we've done with bevacizumab, which is anyone who gets neoadjuvant chemo and there's residual disease, should we maybe then be brave enough to use T-DM1 or offer that to patients who have residual disease? I'm not so certain that's going to accelerate us having T-DM1 in the adjuvant setting. And so I'm kind of go for the big bucks or big effect and actually do a study with single agent T-DM1 in the adjuvant setting. Many of us are using 12 weeks of paclitaxel trastuzumab or, you know, chemo light regimens, I don't know how to say it, where we're not giving TCH to node negative ER positive patients, or even anthracycline taxane, trastuzumab, to node negative ER positive patients. We don't want to give that much chemo. We want to rely on the endocrine therapy and the trastuzumab based therapy. And that's the patient population that I would hope T-DM1 will move into, as opposed to the docetaxel, pertuzumab, trastuzumab adjuvant regimen. As you know, that takes a lot of patients, and it's estimated that if we just enroll kind of the lower risk HER2 positive patients, it's a 8,000 patient study to show an effect somewhere in there, and it would take a long time to accrue. So I think many of us are trying to think of ways to accelerate moving T-DM1 into the adjuvant setting.
It almost feels like it's unprecedented in oncology to be in this situation with these two agents where you really aren't adding toxicity. It's really just a question of, can you get it paid for? And there's all kinds of things that sort of make sense that you might want to consider doing. I love that idea of the post-neo. I imagine like pertuzumab, trastuzumab, chemo, neoadjuvant, surgery, and then if there's residual disease, T-DM1. Is that what you're thinking?
I think a lot of people are thinking that, and I think that seems like a reasonable strategy. My concern is that pertuzumab and trastuzumab are so active and so good that what you might be doing is the residual disease might be the HER2-independent disease, and so therefore you would have to pay some pretty close attention to what that disease looks like after neoadjuvant therapy if it's still in present. And I think that in itself is a very interesting question, which is, if you do have residual disease after receiving these very, very active combinations, is it still HER2-driven, this residual disease? It might not be. And I think a post-neoadjuvant HER2-based trial would really help us understand that, meaning if there's residual disease and you give T-DM1 and there's no benefit, my guess is the reason there's no benefit is because what's left behind after neoadjuvant HER2-based therapy is no longer HER2-dependent. It's escaped that, just like we think of endocrine therapy escape.
Well, the other thing is we still have your old friend lapatinib. You know, we've seen some pretty interesting data, first from you in the metastatic setting with trastuzumab lapatinib. Now, neoadjuvant, we're waiting on the adjuvant. And I don't know, is there any thought about the triplet of lapatinib, trastuzumab, pertuzumab?
There's a lot of thought about it. It's just a matter of how do you get all of the players that would need to be involved, i.e. two different drug companies and safety data and taking away the chemo. Do you need to add the chemo? And so I think everyone is wanting to move forward with that concept of a triplet, or some people are crazy enough to even think about a quadruplet. I do believe that the data that not only from my own study, but from the NeoAlto study, and now from B41, which was a neoadjuvant HER2 based study presented at this year's ASCO, really point to the fact that the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab offers a benefit above and beyond just trastuzumab alone. I think the data also points to that lapatinib alone is probably not as good as trastuzumab alone. So the doublet is the winner across the neoadjuvant and the metastatic trials. And as we have been talking about with all of these new drugs, the dilemma really is, when do you use lapatinib trastuzumab versus trastuzumab alone, especially in very heavily pretreated patients? We don't have a good biomarker for that. And so, unfortunately, we have to go back. I go back to my old keep it simple, stupid concept, which is, I look at what's worked, I look at what's not worked, and for women who have derived benefit from the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab, I'll continue that doublet on and hopefully am able to get it covered. I do believe that lapatinib and trastuzumab in the metastatic setting will receive further consideration here.
So I'm starting to think we're not going to get beyond HER2 today, but that's fine. There's a lot going on for sure.
Sorry. No, I like talking about this stuff.
Oh my God, it's incredible. But I was going to ask you before, and let me ask you now, though. You were talking about adjuvant T-DM1 trials, and I can't remember if I heard this or I dreamed it, but, you know, Dana-Farber had this, because the thinking is, well, maybe, you know, utilize less toxic therapy when you're not sure whether even to use chemo to start with or chemo trastuzumab. And You know, Dana-Farber did this one-arm study with paclitaxel trastuzumab, and obviously it wasn't randomized, but they, you know, they haven't even reported the efficacy data, but we already have seen both investigators and docs in practice utilize it in these lower risk node negative situations. Are they going to do something similar with T-DM1 in the same kind of patients, older patients you don't want to give chemo to? Or is somebody going to do that?
Yeah, I hope so. But again, it goes back to you either do a baby small study and show that it's safe, but then at the end of the day, it doesn't allow you or me to prescribe it in the adjuvant setting. And that's very much what the paclitaxel trastuzumab, which we participated in the Dana-Farber study, for the lower risk adjuvant patients, it would have been great to have kind of chemo light like paclitaxel trastuzumab versus TCH, you know, chemo heavy. I don't know how else to explain it. But because of the numbers of patients, it wasn't designed as a randomized study. Again, I think T-DM1 would be a great drug for low-risk patients. And I think the other combination that many people are interested in is throw out the chemo in these low-risk patients, especially ER-positive patients, and maybe give them endocrine, lapatinib, and trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting. And I know that Eric Weiner has been a proponent of looking at a chemo-free adjuvant randomized trial as well. I think one of us is going to have to be brave enough to go to the mat and say, it's time to get the chemo out of the adjuvant picture. I just don't know which of the breast cancer experts are going to be brave enough to do that. It's so hard to remove treatments that have shown a survival advantage. We're all wed to them.
So if T-DM1 were to become available today, and I would imagine that's certainly a consideration to happen pretty soon, how would you use it in your practice, assuming you can get it paid for?
So in ER-positive, HER2-positive patients, I would start with endocrine therapy and trastuzumab as a standard. So then that puts my patients, it aligns them so that if I need chemo, pertuzumab, trastuzumab as my plan B or my second option, then that's available. I would also consider using T-DM1 before I would use pertuzumab, just because of this therapeutic index thing that I keep going back to, which is hurting the cancer more than you're hurting the patient. I lived through the bone marrow transplant era and in the late 1980s, where I really believed that more chemotherapy would offer patients facing stage 4 breast cancer a cure, and it didn't, and a lot of people got very sick. And so that has shaped my entire approach to the management of metastatic breast cancer patients, which is basically try not to hurt the patient for as long as possible. Or another way of saying that is if the cancer is not hurting the patient, then the treatment shouldn't hurt the patient. And that's really where my bias is going to be more towards utilizing T-DM1 before I use pertuzumab, just because of the chemotherapy backbone required for pertuzumab. Now, other people's approach is probably going to be a little different than mine. They'll give the 6 cycles of docetaxel, pertuzumab, and trastuzumab, and then drop it out. I think both are very, very good options, and especially if the payer environment requires that pertuzumab only be used as the very first chemotherapy-based, HER2-based combination, then I probably will start using more pertuzumab. But for right now, I'm going to try to get away with using T-DM1 in patients that are particularly, not get away, I think I'll use it first because I think it will be covered just like we studied it in Amelia, which is first, second, and third line when it gets approved. And then the real wild card here is getting pertuzumab available to patients past the first line setting.
So I want to just spend the last few minutes maybe getting your take on a few of the things that happened at ASCO, some that you were involved with. But one, you mentioned nab-paclitaxel before, and I know, having worked with you before, that sometimes you use that. And I was curious, Hope Rugo is also on the same program you're on. And of course, one of the things we talked about was her big presentation at ASCO in the CALGB study, comparing paclitaxel to nab-paclitaxel, ixabibulin, pretty much all with bevacizumab. Any thoughts about what you saw there?
Yeah, so I personally believe that there's some advantages to nab-paclitaxel, including the fact that it doesn't have the allergic reaction rate that we see with cremophore solubilized paclitaxel. I think the nab-paclitaxel weekly dosing schedule needs some tweaking. I think in Hope's study, they used 150 milligrams per meter squared, and the neuropathy and neutropenia was higher than what I would like to see, and certainly higher than what we saw with our old-fashioned cream before solubilized paclitaxel. So I think with some better understanding of what the appropriate dosing schedule is, nab-paclitaxel can actually be a very useful agent. And I certainly would like to use it in a weekly setting, weekly schedule in the metastatic setting, in particular for patients who've had cream before solubilized old-fashioned paclitaxel in the adjuvant setting. I just feel like there probably could be some biologic advantage to the nanoparticle albumin component of the nab-paclitaxel. And so I think the biggest drawback with the nab-paclitaxel is really understanding what the appropriate dosing schedule is. When I started at 100 milligrams per meter squared, 3 weeks on, 1 week off. And that's certainly, you know, it's one third less dosing than what she used in her CLGB study. So if you're going to use it on a weekly schedule, just be aware of that the 150 milligrams per meter squared is probably too high of dose.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective because, you know, you watch that presentation and Kathy Miller's discussion after that, and you kind of don't come away thinking you're going to use anything other than paclitaxel with, well, now without bevacizumab.
Yeah, I'll continue. I use a lot of nab-paclitaxel, again, if anything, just due to the lack of need for pre-meds, especially in older patients. But I think the dosing was not as thoroughly explored as we have with our old friend, cream before solubilized paclitaxel, and so it's probably too high of dose.
Another aspect of that presentation was the control arm of, you know, sort of the ECOG paclitaxel bevacizumab kind of looked like the original data with pretty good progression-free survival. And I just wonder where you are today and your thoughts about bevacizumab. I assume you're not using it much.
Well, I have to be cautious what I say, but I use it a lot in combination with paclitaxel. We've not had problems getting it covered. That will probably change. I don't know if I'm personally just flying below the radar screen, but I do continue to use it in combination with paclitaxel. I think the biggest misunderstanding about the Bev, and again, I'm not in charge. If I was in charge, I would have maintained the label, but is that everyone, I think, perceives that we did three studies that were meant to be confirmatory, when I view all three studies as quite different. There was a six-month improvement in progression-free survival for adding the Bev in combination with weekly paclitaxel. We have Avado, which was a less than 1 month advantage, but that was Q3-week docetaxel. Those are two different studies to me. And then we have Ribbon 1, which did not include weekly paclitaxel because the perception at the time Ribbon 1 was designed was we have enough information about weekly paclitaxel and Bev, why would we include it? So they're three completely different studies, and I'm having a little tough time understanding why we are shocked that there were three different results with three different studies. So I continue to use paclitaxel and Bev, in particular for patients where I need to see a response and perhaps they're not eligible for a clinical trial.